gives you the information you need to build freedom, community, and a much better world. Hi, this is Bert Cohen. Recent shows include the status of freedom of the press under President Obama. Is it time to make the Federal Reserve a public utility? Is the dream of Israel over? How is the Tea Party like the Confederacy? The true history of the National Rifle Association, and how is 2014 like 1914? The Bert Cohen Show, every Sunday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. There's really nothing like it.
Catherine, host of Heart of Mind Radio, broadcasting over PRN.FM on Fridays at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. Join me and explore your inner world, your divine self, and your sacred path. Listen and be inspired by authors, healers, shamans, scientists, mystics, and you. Yes, your calls are most important of all. You can listen to Heart of Mind Radio on the archives anytime, 24/7. And please don't forget, rate the show on iTunes. I bring my 30 years experience as a teacher, spiritual doula, and vibrational healer. That's Fridays at 10 a.m.
Mondays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time for the premiere of Women's Rights in the Workplace with Jack Tuckner, that's me, when I'll be talking with you about sex discrimination in the workplace and what you can do to protect yourself. Each week, my guests and I will discuss all forms of workplace discrimination affecting women, such as your right to maternity leave, and what you need to know about workplace sexual harassment, and what to do about that harassment if it's happening to you or to someone you love. I'll take your calls and answer your questions as well. Please tune in live on Mondays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM. If you miss the show live, you can listen at your convenience on PRN.FM at any time. And if you like what you hear, please rate the show on iTunes.
Have you ever listened to Anthony Robbins, watched the movie called The Secret, or read about the power of positive thinking from the perspective of any of the many fine authors who have written about the subject? They all focus on the law of attraction, which governs every second of every life of every person in the universe. Like attracts like, and everything you do, feel, and think about as a regular way of being determines your life experiences. PRN's new show, LOA Today, explores all aspects of this magnificent law of the universe every Thursday evening from 7 to 8 p.m. Join hosts Walt Thiessen and Yuona June Thiessen as we explore the law of attraction each week. That's LOA Today, Thursday evenings from 7 to 8 p.m. here on PRN.
Does the current dire state of the economy have you totally upset and confused? There are solutions to our financial ills, but first we have to get a handle on what's really going on. I'm Ellen Brown, author of Web of Debt and a new radio show host here on PRN-FM, inviting you to join me and my co-host, Walt McCree, as we look behind the curtain at the shadowy world of global monetary control and what we can do to break ourselves free. The show is called It's Our Money, and it airs on Wednesdays at 3 p.m. Eastern. We'll be talking with experts in the world of monetary policy, as well as with people who are actively working to reclaim control of public money to benefit the public interest. So please join us for It's Our Money, Wednesdays on PRN, FM, or by podcast.
Why would anyone ride on top of an elevator, lug around an 11-pound large print dictionary, or compete in a swim race unable to see the course? Well, this is me, and I've got some riveting experiences to share with you. Hey, I'm Mark Farrell. Join me for Insight, a new show coming to PRN.FM. It's about overcoming adversity, and who doesn't experience this in some capacity? I'm no doctor, but I'm an expert in me since I've been dealing with various forms of adverse conditions all my life, like having a rare visual disability that challenges much of what I do. insight, real-life issues, including mental health, anxiety, depression, suicide, drugs, and alcohol. Celebrity guests will also reveal an insight how they overcame adversity to make it, as well as your calls on challenges you struggle with. My difference makes me stronger. That's my mantra. Listen and discover how your difference makes you stronger. Insight, Thursdays at 11 a.m. only on PRN.FM.
The Progressive Radio News Hour is an antidote to government and corporate propaganda. Distinguished guests are featured. Some are world figures. All are independent thinkers. Truth and full disclosure are featured. Vital domestic and world issues mattering most are discussed. Today is the most perilous time in world history. Ukraine's crisis escalated things dangerously. It's the gravest one since World War II. A potential clash of civilizations looms. More than ever, vital information is needed. It's our most precious commodity. How we use it matters most. Peace and security depend on it. The Progressive Radio News Hour, three times weekly, live on Sundays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, plus two pre-recorded archive programs. Make it a regular habit and stay informed.
This is Cliff Stewart with A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. AJC Coast to Coast is the place to listen to topics about the fight against wrongful convictions, judicial injustice, and corruption. Join us every Sunday with Sam Thurman, Ethel Lopez, and me from 10:30 a.m. to 12:30 Eastern Time on Progressive Radio Network. That's PRN.FM.
This is journalist Dave Lindorf. I'll be hosting the show This Can't Be Happening each Wednesday at 5 p.m. Eastern on PRN.FM. Because we know it is happening, each week's program will feature some issue that's been getting ignored or misreported, like Social Security, climate change, military spending, or the government's destruction of the Internet. Please join me at This Can't Be Happening on Wednesday at 5 p.m. Eastern.
B-R-O-N-X, you know what's next.
It's a bowl of soul. Tune in and get your dose of classic soul and independent R&B music from the United States and abroad on Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. A Bowl of Soul is a music experience you won't forget or regret. Check out A Bowl of Soul on the Progressive Radio Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to invite you to listen to Warrior Connection on the Progressive Radio Network. Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we're doing the best we can for the veterans of our nation. Warrior Connection is an ongoing discussion with veterans, scientists, politicians, journalists, reporters, and doctors about the health and environmental effects of war on our nation's veterans. Our purpose is to provide the information necessary for all veterans to lead a productive life. Thank you very much, and God bless America.
This is Mike Fader. Let me tell you about PRN.FM. It's a whole new world of broadcasting. PRN has absolutely no question the best political and economic shows on the radio. Plus, PRN tops every other station in its health and wellness program. Cooking, music, book reviews, sex advice, you name it, we have it. I'm going to tell you this one time. You need to listen to our programming, okay? All right? Don't make me come down here.
Stay tuned for the best information on health and nutrition, current events, economics, the environment, and more on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
And welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. It is a beautiful Thursday morning here in New York, and I hope the rest of you are enjoying beautiful weather wherever you are. I'm really happy to be here with all of you. Well, yesterday was Earth Day, and in celebration of Earth Day, I joined my local cinema at a screening of a film called Planetary, which was really interesting. I mean, it was a little on the long side, but what I really enjoyed about the film was it gave you the perspective of the Earth as its own living organism. And it just kind of explained how the paradigm shifted when we took to space. Hi, everybody. Sorry about that. Technical difficulty. Anyway, I'm back. So this film was just really very special, and it was really nice, the conversation that came out afterwards. Just talking about, as a human species, we are very disconnected from each other, and we really need to work towards bringing people together again. And that's, you know, something that I focus on a lot is community. And I think one of the main messages coming out of this film is how disconnected we all are. And they actually interviewed people today and said that people today are, you know, in general, less happy and have many fewer friends than they did 50 years ago. And part of what's happening is, you know, the suburban sprawl of moving away from urban centers and living in bigger homes, more spread out, and there's not that sense of community that that once was. And so I think people that are living in, you know, cities where they know their neighbors, where they're getting out, where there is a certain grassroots movement to bring people together, are definitely getting that sense of community and bringing people back together. And I think that's something that we all will benefit from if we focus on that. And so anyway, happy Earth Day to all of you. And I hope you all continue to connect with each other, because that's what we need to do. This weekend is a wonderful opportunity for connecting and for looking at our planet as a species, and that is the Long Island Food Conference, which is coming up at Hofstra this Saturday. It's something that you've been hearing me talk about for months. We've been planning it for many, many months, and it's finally coming up. Our keynote speaker is Stephen Ritz, who is from the Green Bronx Machine, and he is a teacher in the South Bronx, and he has been for years working with kids, showing them how to plant gardens, vertical gardens, any type of gardens, how to eat better, how to grow your own food, and giving them a skill that they can really use and transforming their lives. Through food, he is transforming their lives. He's engaging them in school. He's engaging them in learning. They've gone from like a 40% graduation rate to a 93% graduation rate. He's gotten accolades and awards up the wazoo, and he's just really an amazing, amazing man. So I recommend everybody, if you can come out to Hofstra this Saturday for the food conference, to please come. There's over 30 different workshops and speakers throughout the day. There's a great end-of-the-day reception and networking forum. There's an exhibition hall with over 50 exhibitors showing their green products and green companies. So that also should be really interesting. There's hands-on workshops. There's a full day of kids' workshops going on simultaneously, and kids are free. So it's really going to be a day for the whole family, and if you can make it, I'm actually going to be giving a lunchtime keynote speaking performance along with a cooking demonstration. Getting dinner on the table is a political act, and that's what I'm calling it. And that's really what I believe. I feel like we all need to empower ourselves and take back our knives and start cooking. And it's amazing how much, how many of our everyday problems I think will get solved just by that simple act. A lot of other things are going on. This weekend in New York City is the Green Festival Expo, and that's at the Javits Center, and it is Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and Sunday, actually. And it's $12 per day to get in, but it's a whole convention center filled with people showing their green products, and should be an interesting thing. On April 28th, there is a labeling rally and lobby day up in Albany, and Food and Water Watch has organized, once again, buses from around the state. And if you can get on one of those buses, I know I will be there. It's really a wonderful, empowering experience to get on one of those buses and go to Albany and be there with hundreds or thousands of other people demanding and asking and pleading that they pass the bills that they have in both the Senate and the Assembly to ban fracking, or at least to label fracking, I should say. To label fracking. I'm so sorry. To label GMOs. I'm all over the place this morning. Forgive me. But this is for labeling GMOs. And we really need to get that GMO labeling. 93% of all Americans want GMO labeling. Over 40 other countries around the world have GMO labeling. But our government, as I've said so many times, are thinking more about the corporations that are producing the GMO products than they are thinking about their people. And so we all need to get out there and let it be known that we do not want GMOs in our food, and if they're going to be in our food, we at least want them labeling. Right now, in Congress, they are passing the first GMO salmon. That is going to be hitting our plates soon, and GMO apples. There's a whole list of new GMO potato. These are all new products that we do not need and we do not want. And it's really important that we let our voices be heard. And we really can make change. And that's one of the things that I'm really excited about. My guest today, who will be on in a little bit, Anna Lappe, she, along with her mother, have been working tirelessly for many years. Her mom was the author of Diet for a Small Planet, which is the book that first inspired me to become vegetarian at the age of 16. And that was not because I loved animals so much, although I do, or because I was concerned about my own health, which I am. It was because that book explained to me that the whole concept of not having enough food on the planet was a myth and was being created by the industrial agricultural system that we have. And the production of meat in this country adds so much to the greenhouse gas emissions and is responsible for one-third of all the greenhouse gas emissions on the planet, along with cars, et cetera. So I just knew there had to be a change. And Anna Lappe has been working alongside with her mother. She just has a new book out called Diet for a Hot Planet, The Climate Crisis at the End of Your Fork and What You Can Do About It. And it's an amazing book. She's also in charge of the Real Food Media Project, and that is a project creating videos to educate people about the food system. So I'm really excited for Anna to be coming on in a little bit. Also going on in the city, May 5th, there's a screening of GMO OMG, which is another great film similar to Genetic Roulette about the downsides of GMOs and what we need to do about it. So if you can come to that, more information is always for all these things is on my website at iegreen.com. May 7th, also up in Albany, is the New York State Anti-Hunger Conference. That's an all-day event from 8 to 5. It costs $40, but it's well worth it. If you are working in hunger, if you care about hunger and poverty, this is a conference to really attend. May 9th, Riverkeeper, which is a great organization really helping to bring back the Hudson River. They are having a cleanup day on May 9th, and there's over 90 cleanup sites along the Hudson River, and you can go onto their website to sign up and help clean up the river. Lots of other events. I'm not going to do them all now on the air, but please go to my website and see what else is going on. Lots of stuff, but I do hope to see many of you at the Long Island Food Conference this weekend. It's really going to be a great event. I want to share a recipe with you before I invite my guest on. This is an escargot pasta with eggplant and carrots and shaved Parmesan cheese. And it's called escargot pasta just because they look like little snails, but you can really use any shaped pasta that you like. I had an organic pasta here that I used that was really quite delicious. So I used a pound of pasta. And one of the things during the week, when you want to get dinner on the table really fast, pasta is a great thing. Sometimes I use real pasta, but very often I'm using brown rice noodles, you know, just to keep it gluten-free. But it's a really quick meal, and you really can use anything that you have in your refrigerator. That's one of the beauties of having a full pantry, whether you have anchovies or olives or capers. Those are all great things to put in with pasta. This dish is, I had eggplant and carrots in my cupboard, or in my refrigerator, along with some shaved Parmesan. So here we go. 1 pound of pasta, 1 onion chopped, 3 cloves garlic minced, 1 bunch of broccoli cut into bite-sized florets, 3 carrots peeled and then sliced into chunks or julienne strips, whatever you like. I used 1.5 Chinese eggplants. They were long, so I just felt like 2 was going to be too many, so I just did 1.5 Chinese eggplants, and I chopped that up into bite-sized pieces, not too small. 1/2 cup of grated Parmesan cheese, 1 lemon juiced, some olive oil for sautéing, 1/4 cup of fresh Italian parsley chopped, salt and pepper to taste, and shaved Parmesan for garnishing. So you cook the pasta according to directions al dente. Meanwhile, cover the bottom of a large wok with some olive oil. Add the onions and cook those until they're translucent. Then add the eggplant, the carrots, and the garlic. And cook for 5 more minutes, adding more olive oil if necessary. And usually you have to because the eggplant seems to absorb a lot of olive oil. Then add the broccoli and cook for 5 more minutes until all the vegetables are tender. Turn off the flame. Add the shredded cheese, the lemon juice, and the parsley, salt and pepper to taste. And then mix in the pasta and just toss that all together. If you'd like it a little wetter, you can save a little bit of the pasta water and add a little bit of pasta water into the pasta. Otherwise, it can be a little dry, which I like. But if you want it to be a little wetter, you can add a little bit of the pasta water. And then you place it on a platter, garnish with some fresh parsley and shaved Parmesan, and serve that immediately. And it's quite delicious. Okay, so now it's my pleasure to introduce my guest, Anna Lappe. Anna, are you with me?
Yes.
Hi, Anna. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Sure. Thank you for being willing to wake up so early. I know you're in California now. We miss you here in New York.
I am. But I do have young children, so I always wake up early. So This is normal.
Well, good. So I told people a little bit about your work, but maybe you can just share with them a little bit about the Small Planet Institute and the work that you're doing with the Small Planet Fund as well.
Sure. So I sort of like to think of it as kind of getting into the family business in a way. I heard in your intro you were talking about my mother's work. And starting when she was in her early 20s, she started exploring the root causes of hunger, and it kind of put her on a lifelong path to explore how do we resolve, I think, one of the most fundamental questions of our time, which is how do we address hunger, and how do we address hunger in a world of plenty today? There are almost a billion people going hungry, and yet there is more than enough food to feed everyone. And that was a question that propelled her starting from an early age. And when I was in my mid-20s, I was a graduate student in New York City, and I was very interested in similar questions. My mother and I ended up writing a book together. It's called Hope's Edge, and we traveled to India, Bangladesh, Kenya, Poland, Brazil, a couple places in the U.S., some other countries, mm-hmm. and through that experience just had an incredible, incredible life-changing experience of really talking to people on the ground who are trying to figure out how to create truly sustainable food systems and healthier communities and eradicate hunger. And that experience really set me on a lifelong path myself. And so ever mm-hmm. since then, we've been working with the Small Planet Institute, Small Planet Fund, and really trying to figure out how can we communicate about these issues in ways that help people think differently about their own role in the world, their own food choices, and the kinds of policies that we could put into place to address those linkages between hunger, the environment, climate.
Yeah, all of them. You know, one of the things I loved about Hope's Edge, because, you know, I did read it, and I just think it's an amazing book, is that it is hopeful. I mean, it's so refreshing to hear a perspective that is a little hopeful, because so often in the circle of work that you're doing and that I'm doing about talking about the climate change and the food production and everything that's going on in the world with government, et cetera, it can be quite depressing. And Hope's Edge really just brought another side to it that really gave you hope, that you saw that there were so many people on the ground really working to make change and actually developing sustainable systems that are working within their small communities.
Yeah.
And it was really encouraging.
Yeah, well, that's so lovely to hear. That was certainly, that was certainly our experience of that research trip. It was that we were so clear-eyed about just how enormous are the challenges people are facing. One of the movements that we write about in the book is called the Landless Workers Movement. It's based in Brazil, and it's helping to mobilize hundreds of thousands of families to help landless workers, landless farmers, get access to land, start farming cooperatives. They started the first organic seed line in the entire country of Brazil, really doing incredible work. And that was so inspiring. And at the same time, these people in this movement were up against such repression that since the founding of the movement in the mid-80s, hundreds of these members of the movement had been killed in the struggle. So this wasn't just, we were very clear-eyed. It wasn't just kind of Pollyanna skipping around looking at just the positive stories. The positive
right.
stories were embedded in these stories of struggle. But, I certainly found that the people that we were meeting to write that book were the most hopeful people that I have ever met. And I was struck by that everywhere we went. And I was struck that these were the most hopeful people I had ever met, and yet they were faced with some of the starkest challenges of anybody I ever knew. And so it really sort of forced me to redefine what I mean by hope and where I think hope comes from. And that was really at the core of the book, was that redefinition of hope and embracing hope with this much more clear-eyed view of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one of the things also that I think came out really strong was the sense of community that they've created. You know, at the beginning of my show, I don't know if you heard, I was talking about our lack of community here in this country for so many people. So many people live somewhat in isolation or have a few friends, but, you don't have that larger group that you feel like you're a part of. And
I think that's, you know, something that's also really special that gives them strength, that strength in power and in numbers and strength in community that hard to get here.
Yeah, well, I think that's kind of like the little secret that no one tells you about being an activist or an advocate or kind of whatever term you want to use, but being engaged, trying to make a difference in the world, trying to make something better. I think the little secret that no one tells you is that it's a great way to make friends. It's a great way to have that community experience, to really feel part of something bigger than yourself. And that was the story we heard about what hope really meant to people, and where real hope comes from is that we heard again and again that hope comes from the act of taking action, that hope comes from being engaged in that way and not sitting on the sidelines. And that to me is one of the lessons that I hope people get from that book and from all the work that I do, all the stories I tell of people that are trying to really work to make change, to make things better, is that sense that it does, it feels good, it's fun, it makes you, and it gives you a source of hope that you otherwise wouldn't have.
Mm-hmm. And you're so right. That is my community, you know, and it helps you find all the great people that live in your area. It's like if you're on that same mission, you share that passion, you share that work, you're getting together not just to hang, but getting together to, like, do something. And it's empowering. It's really so nice. So you're lucky. What a great family business to be born into, huh?
I couldn't agree more.
Very lucky. Could have been something else.
Could have been
a
Halliburton.
Right. That's true. So, so let's talk about your book, Diet for a Hot Planet, which has, you know, gotten some great recognition, and it's really inspiring people around our parts anyway, if not around the world. Can you talk a little bit about that and what inspired you and motivated you to write that book?
Sure. So I was inspired to write Diet for a Hot Planet because, as I mentioned, I was working on food and agriculture issues and sustainability and exploring all those questions, and I kept stumbling upon these dense 100-page or more reports about the connection between food and sort of our food system more broadly and climate change. And I was struck in one of these reports I read, it was from the United Nations, and it talked about the connection between just livestock production alone and climate change. And it found that if you analyzed all of what it takes to put meat and dairy on our tables, if you look at all of that, all of that production, that the emissions, the greenhouse gas emissions associated with livestock production alone were, at the time this report came out, more than all transportation combined, more than all the airplanes and cars and buses and trucks traveling all around the planet. Livestock production alone was more impactful than all of that. And I just stopped in my tracks, and I thought, I'm not hearing about this. I'm not hearing about livestock. And, of course, you know, livestock is just a subset of our food system more broadly. When you look at food system more broadly, as we mentioned, you're talking about almost a third of all emissions. And I had this moment where I thought, you know, I'm not hearing anybody talk about this. I was looking at all of the big green groups, all the big environmental groups who I so admired, and they were doing great campaigns around climate. But none of them were talking about food and making that connection.
Right.
And then as I dug deeper, what I found is there's this really incredible story about the connections between sustainable agriculture, so using organic production practices, doing things like really paying attention to soil fertility, building soil fertility through ecological methods like nitrogen-fixing crops, that when you start looking at the science around sustainable systems, you actually find this incredibly great story, which is that sustainable farms are much more resilient at moments of climate shock. Sustainable farms release much fewer greenhouse gas emissions, use much less energy, use much less water, and so on and so on and so on. And so I thought, wow, here's a story. Here's a story about how our current system is so destructive and such a part of the problem. And on the other hand, here's a story about how this kind of new system that's emerging and this new way of thinking about farming, tapping into a lot of indigenous ancient practices but bringing in some very, very modern science, that this new way of thinking about farming is actually part of the climate solution. And those were the two sides of the story I wanted to tell, and a story that I felt like at the time nobody was talking about. So it inspired me. I definitely wasn't planning on writing another book, but I was so inspired to learn more myself and then share that with people that was how Diet for a Hot Planet was born.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, like you said, in Diet for a Small Planet, your mom's book, you know, she just touched on that, but we weren't as focused on we weren't as focused or in tune with that.
That's right. That's right. I mean, yeah, we had no idea. I mean, the very first congressional hearing on climate change was 1979. So it was a long time ago, but it was after Diet for a Small Planet. And then, of course, in terms of our real popular understanding of climate change, you know, that's come much more recently. And so you're absolutely right. My mother and I like to think of our books, and this is why I titled it Diet for a Hot Planet and really made that connection to her book, is that we like to see our books kind of in conversation with each other across a generation. So what I'm saying is that, you know, there's a conversation that continues in Diet for a Hot Planet that began in Diet for a Small Planet, which is a conversation asking questions about the environmental impact, the social impact, and economic impact of a set of food choices that we're making, and asking the question of you know, how can we make those choices differently, and what would that look like, and how would that benefit us?
Mm-hmm. You know, the conference that I'm helping to organize is coming up this weekend, the Long Island Food Conference. One of the panels that we have going is, which is more sustainable, organic, local, or plant-based? And, you know, it should be an interesting dialogue. I'm just curious as to what your feelings on that would be.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would if I were on that panel, I would sort of maybe I would be the disruptor and say that's asking the wrong question. Because I think ultimately it's not about choosing between those. It's about really thinking about how do we get from where we are today, which is this very, very destructive system where agriculture is the, you know, biggest polluter of water and a major polluter of air and, you know, and so on and so on, to a system that works much better. So I would say, you know, that's kind of not, that, you know, I would try to sort of get away from answering that tough question by saying, let's ask a different one. But I would also say around that local versus organic, I mean, that's a question I hear a lot of audiences when I speak asking that question. You know, I think that, again, in a way, maybe my answer is a little bit of that's not the right question, but I tend to stress the need. I really stress the need for preserving farmland and really protecting and honoring farmers, whatever practices they're using today. And I say that because in my work, I constantly meet farmers who transition from chemical farming to organic farming, who make that leap and who express how many benefits they see from making that leap, but also who share how hard it is to make that transition, and that it doesn't happen overnight, and that it takes a whole new way of understanding how to farm your land. It takes a lot of economic resources that here in this country we don't offer farmers to help them transition the way other countries do. So I think that on that local versus organic, I like to say, well, let's protect our farmers first, no matter what practices they're using today. If we let those farms disappear, if we let those farms get paved over and become, you know, a strip mall or a Walmart or whatever, to try to get that back into farmland is virtually impossible. So let's protect farmers first, if that means, you know, supporting farmers locally who might not be using exactly the practices that you know, are the gold standard of environmentalism. You know, I say let's protect those farmers. So that's kind of how I like to answer that question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I guess I want to protect the farmers that are coming to listen to you talk and are thinking about transitioning, but the bigger farms have no intention or are not trying at all to transition.
Right, right. Well, and then that gets to kind of what our definition of local is. I mean, I like to say, look, you know, a lot of people live near, you know, Tyson meatpacking plants. Does that meat local? No.
Right.
You know,
right.
To me, local is actually, this might sound again like sort of skirting the question, but I like to define local as more, less about proximity and more about connection. So I like to think of local as, like I said, you know, you could be down the street from a Twinkie plant or down the street from a meatpacking factory, right? That's not local. To me, local is about shortening the distance between an eater and a producer. And so again, what I'm saying is maybe there's some producers who aren't, you know, fully organic, but let's support them and help them get there. And similarly, you know, this brings up the reason why I'm a huge advocate for supporting, you know, fair trade farmers. I mean, I have two young kids. They eat bananas. We are not growing bananas in Northern California.
Right.
But I buy fair trade organic. And even though that's not kind of local, I have shortened that distance of that supply chain in a way that I feel like is meaningful and that ultimately benefits the planet and people. So I think there is kind of an element of, you know, for those things in those foods that we can't get locally, I'm not a local purist. I'm not eating a 100-mile diet all the time. Like I said, my husband and I drink coffee. My kids eat bananas, for instance.
Right.
But it is about, you know, our having, you can still, thankfully, because of social movements around the world, you can have a connection to these products that are otherwise, you know, I wouldn't have access to. I wouldn't be able to get my coffee fix in the morning without these social movements that have helped me have that much more direct connection to, you know, coffee farmers half a world away. So I think that's kind of part of my definition of what's that kind of food system that we're moving toward. Again, I know, you know, I have plenty of friends that are local purists that don't drink coffee or eat bananas, but to be, you know, not hypocritical, to be honest, to how I consume food and how I think most of us do, we're always going to have an element of trade and long distance, long distance trade for what we eat and drink.
Right. So just making those better choices.
Mm-hmm.
Since your book came out, have you seen changes that you find encouraging? And are there issues which you feel have more urgency than others?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that question because it's, absolutely, yes, is my answer. I'm so thrilled to see, first of all, just I feel like how much more of an understanding people have about climate change more generally, but specifically around food, how more and more people get it. There's been so many more articles, so much more coverage, so many more people talking about this connection. I was able to march with my mom in the People's Climate March in New York City, and there was an entire section of marchers on the theme of food and climate, and the Organic Consumers Association and many other groups were the organizers of that section, and very clear that the message is how much industrial agriculture and chemical agriculture is part of the problem, and then also how organic farming can help, as they put it, cool the planet. So to me, that moment of being at the climate march, my mom and I both spoke briefly at a rally in the kind of food contingent, that to me was this sort of pinnacle moment of feeling like the conversation has really shifted,
mm-hmm.
and that this is really on the map in terms of climate change. All of the big environmental groups that work on climate, I can't say they all have robust programs on food and agriculture yet, but many of them at least have, at least compared to when I first looked into this, you know, now it's almost 8 years ago, they have, you know, information on their websites. They're talking about it, and some really have really powerful campaigns. So much has changed. It's very exciting to see. Of course, we have much more education to do, but I feel at least there is something, a shift that I can really measure, point to, and celebrate.
Yeah, I agree with you. I also was in that food contingency part of the march.
Yeah, it was so inspiring, wasn't it?
It was. It really was. And it was a great day, and I had my three kids with me. And, yeah, I just felt really great, and it was so nice to be a part of another million other people who also felt the importance to be there. So it was really moving. So I got to hear your TEDx talk. I was there in the audience in New York. Was it last year or the year before when you talked about?
It would be the year before.
The year mm-hmm. before, right? Talking about the marketing to children.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, also as a mom, I just think that is such a huge, important issue. Can you talk to us a little bit about
you know, marketing junk food to kids, and what you think parents can do to try to help this?
Sure. So as a mom, as I said, I've got two young kids, and you know, I feel like I had sort of on the edges of consciousness been aware of kind of how much the junk food, fast food, sugary drinks industry targets children. But until you're a mom, you don't really see it so clearly because
you're not
it's targeting
those
children. I mean, that's the thing. I talk to audiences and say, Anna, you know, I just don't think you're right. I don't think it's so ubiquitous. And I said, well, you're, you know, in one case I was talking to this woman and I was very gentle in my response to her, but you know, she was a middle-aged white woman. I'm like, yes, you're not a 16-year-old African-American boy and you're not a 7-year-old Latina girl. And, you know, the point of my message around marketing is it is so targeted today and it is also being so targeted to young people. So the numbers, to give you all a sense of how extensive this is, this industry self-reports, the food industry self-reports that it spends almost $2 billion a year in marketing directly to children and teens. And that's just what they self-report. And it also doesn't account for all the marketing they do of products that children are seeing that marketing for, but they're not saying it's targeting them. So, for instance, when Coca-Cola advertises on American Idol, they don't consider that marketing to children because they say American Idol's target audience is really older people, even though, of course, you know, mm-hmm. we know lots of kids are watching it, right? So, so they're spending about $2 billion a year in that targeted marketing, and kids are really inundated. And it's not just in the traditional ways. You know, a lot of people say, well, then just, you know, have children watch less TV and they won't see it. What's important for people to understand is that the way children are marketed to today, it is ubiquitous throughout their day. So it's everything from, yes, it's on television, but it's also on their cereal boxes that connects their cereal or food products to their favorite characters like Dora or SpongeBob. It's also in their classrooms. There's ridiculous things like Reese's Pieces counting books where teachers, you know, are getting these free books ostensibly to teach curriculum, but really marketing products. Schools are advertising. I mean, schools have sponsorships with food companies for, you know, putting their logo on sports fields or having other ways in which there's those kinds of partnerships. And especially what's happening is major infiltration online, on social media, where a lot of kids are today, in ways that often, you know, kids don't perceive as advertising, but it still is marketing brands and marketing products. And all the research shows that this marketing works. It gets kids to prefer certain brands. It also just gets them to eat more junk food in general. And we know that, we've known for a long time, that kids, especially children under age 8, is kind of that pivot point in terms of neurological development, but that children literally are unable to perceive advertising as different from information. And so advocates say, you know, marketing to kids, it's inherently deceptive because children don't know they're being marketed to, and yet the industry really is, and targeting children really heavily. So I think that elevating the conversation about marketing to kids is really important for a number of reasons, but especially because it's you know, really part of, I think, part of what's driving the epidemic of diet-related illnesses, and I just think it's just immoral at its core. So that is kind of my overview. And as a mom, of course, you know, I take this issue, it affects me personally. You know, I really take it to heart, and really have empathy for other parents that struggle with this every day.
Right. It's so hard. I remember more than once my child having a temper tantrum in the supermarket, wanting something that I wasn't going to give them, and, you know, having to leave right there. And, you know, it's hard. It's really hard to battle, you know, especially if you have a strong-willed child, and you just want to make them happy. And, you know, you think that just giving in is going to make them happy, and in the long run it really doesn't, and we have to stay strong. And that's why support from so many other people is really important. And what I found really interesting when you talk about the marketing, our government has so little available funds to counter that marketing, to like try to give healthy messages out there. It can't compare.
Right, and it's too early for my brain to recall the precise number, but yes, I remember doing some comparisons just to give people that sense of what we're up against. So I looked at the budget of the CDC for their, you know, five-a-day program to promote fruits and vegetables, and I think it was something like, you know, half of what Kellogg spends to promote Frosted Flakes every year or something ridiculous.
I've done the same research.
Exactly. So it is exactly right. And I think, you know, what you said about your experience with your kid in the supermarket, we've all been there. You know, to me, where the outrage comes from is these companies are getting in the middle, right in the middle of the most important relationships in our life.
Right.
And they don't belong there, you know. And luckily, I'm very lucky to shop at a grocery store, a locally owned big grocery store, but that has really wonderful, wonderful products. It has very little junk food. The cereal aisle has very little junky cereal. And, you know, at the cash registers where typically, you know, there's a lot of children eye level candy.
Children candy.
You know, all that stuff, right? Doesn't have any of that. And I take my kids shopping, both my kids come with me shopping, and it's a joy. We have a great time.
Right.
They don't whine. They don't ask for anything they don't ask for anything that they can't have. They ask for, you know, grapes or strawberries or, but, you know, it's a pleasure. And I think about how many people I took them shopping at a more traditional grocery store once, and it was a total nightmare. It was, you know, dragging them through the aisle, said, no, you can't have marshmallows. No, you can't have that, right? And that's what most people face at a typical grocery store. So I really feel like this is, you know, so important to talk about, and especially, as you said, that imbalance between the marketing dollars on the one hand and those educational dollars to really teach healthy eating on the other.
Mm-hmm. Anna, let's take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I want to talk about the Real Food Media project that you're involved in, because that's also really, really getting out there and helping people make better choices. So everyone out there listening, don't go anywhere. I'll be right back, and my guest is Anna Lappe. Be right back.
Tuned to PRN. We'll keep bringing you the best in alternative voices for social and political news, the environment, health, the economy, and a whole lot more. All you have to do is keep listening. PRN, the Progressive Radio Network. Gary Null's incisive documentary and informational films on today's most crucial issues have won dozens of international awards. As a free service to listeners, acclaimed films such as War on Health and Seeds of Death are available to watch in their entirety online. Just go to YouTube and search for Gary Null. Thank you for your continued support.
I'm Sam Thurman of A Just Cause Coast to Coast. Join me along with Cliff Stewart and Ethel Lopez right here on Progressive Radio Network, that's PRN.FM, each Sunday morning from 10:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Eastern Time for A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice.
Hi there, this is Harvey Wasserman. I am the host of the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show, which airs every Monday at 3 p.m. at PRN.FM. We cover the great issues of your health and wellness, of the health and wellness of the planet, of moving ahead towards a Solartopian, green-powered, holistic Earth. Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Normally, you would hear the Progressive Commentary Hour Monday evenings, 7 to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. However, as of today, we're going to be having it every Tuesday, 7 to 8 p.m. So just change your calendar, please. Change your schedule. Tuesday, 7 to 8 for the Progressive Commentary Hour.
This is Guy McPherson. Join me and Mike Sleva with Nature Bats Last Radio on PRN.FM. Catch us Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. on the East Coast. You can rate the show on iTunes, and if you don't catch us live, you can catch us 24/7 in the PRN archives. That's 8 p.m. Eastern Time with Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM.
This is PRN, PRN for the Progressive Radio Network.
Everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and my guest today is Anna Lappe from the Small Planet Institute and author of Diet for a Hot Planet. Anna, are you with me?
Yes.
Great. So the Real Food Media Project, which is the videos that you promote and produce, you actually had a contest going on this year. Was this the first time that you offered that contest?
It was our second year of doing our short films contest and films on food and sustainability.
Yeah, can you tell us a little bit about that and, and how did it work out? How many films did you get?
Yeah, it's been so much fun. So the Real Food Media Project grew out of my interest in really trying to come up with creative ways to help tell a story of this incredible movement. I'm certainly witnessing, I know you see it in your work, all around the country of bringing to life sustainable food and connecting people to where their food comes from and getting greater access to good, healthy food into communities that don't have it. So we do a number of different initiatives, and one of them is this short films competition. We have wonderful judges who are working with us, people like Padma Lakshmi and Tom Colicchio from Top Chef, and Alice Waters and Michael Pollan, and wonderful people, wonderful journalists, wonderful film critics. And our vision was to put a call to both professional filmmakers and up-and-coming filmmakers and film students to create short films. They're all under 4 minutes on various themes, and then also on, we sort of also leave it open for people to really submit on any topic they want, and connected to food and sustainability. And we have partners with schools, film schools around the country, and organizations and media entities. And we started, as I mentioned, 2 years ago. We have received more than 300 submissions since we started. And it's been so much fun to see the diversity of stories, the diversity of styles. And the 10 winning films each year are available for streaming online, for hosting. Anybody anywhere could host what we call our pop-up film festivals. So we've had about 140 film festivals happen across the world. Actually, there was some folks in New Zealand and Romania and Turkey and other places in other parts of the world that have showcased the 10 films on their own. And so all of that's available. It's all at realfoodmedia.org. And we've just had so much fun doing it. We're hoping to do it for a third year. We give big cash prizes to the winners, but also we really promote the films. So not just in the festivals, but we have media partners that are promoting the films on websites. We also have film festival partners that are promoting the films at film festivals. So it's been a thrill. It's been really fun. And, it's amazing how much you can pack into a film that's only 4 minutes long.
Right. Well, we actually showed, I had a food and film feast last month at our local art cinema, and we showed two of your films. One was, how to, do we really need industrial food to feed the world?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that was great. And then also about the Ethiopian coffee cooperative, which was another
great
film. But I would love to have our slow food chapter host one of these pop-up screenings. They sound really
you know, it would be perfect. You put the reel all together for you, it sounds like,
we
right?
We do. Yeah, yeah. And they're really fun. I've attended a few and then just heard feedback from others. And they're fun. They're, because the films are so short and they touch on so many different issues, they're real conversation sparkers and idea generators. They're also, because the films are so short in length, you could do the whole reel and still have a lot of time for other programming at an event. We've also found that one of the events I just participated in was a film festival that had a farm-to-table dinner one night where they were celebrating a local food and farm nonprofit and our films. And we did this farm-to-table meal where between each course, we showed a couple of the films. And then and I got up and spoke a little bit between each course. But it was a really lovely way to have some programming interspersed with a meal. So people are also doing that kind of thing with the films. I've also heard them used, sounds like in a way, how you guys used two of the films recently, where they've also been used by people that are planning conferences or events where they've chosen one or two or three or a few of the films that relate to a conference theme and showed them at a conference. Mm-hmm. The other thing I should mention is I said we had 300 submissions over time. So the top 10 each year, so 20 films are part of our pop-up film festivals, but we also have released another 25 films in our film library, which is also at that website, realfoodmedia.org. And that film library is organized thematically, so we have films on food entrepreneurship, films on women in food, and that's another resource that anybody anywhere can tap into, again, for courses, teaching, for conferences, for events, or just to watch, you know, at your desk on your own computer. But that's also a resource that the Real Food Media Project has created and made available.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's great. I think video is just such a wonderful way to get so much information, like you said, packed into a short amount of time and reach a lot of people. So it's great work. Thank you so much. So I wanted to also talk about, one thing that I hear you say a lot is you need to go actually beyond just your fork to help fix this food system. You want to share a little bit more about what you mean by that and how you can give some examples maybe of organizing that people can do?
Mm-hmm, sure. Well, one of my heroes in this work, Winona Howder, who's the head of Food and Water Watch, this is kind of her rallying cry, which is that we can't just consume differently. We have to organize. And Food and Water Watch and other groups are really showing how, helping connect people who want to get more active to campaigns in their community and really having real successes. So one of the issues that Food and Water Watch has been working on is fracking, and they have really helped me along with other groups in an allyship with other groups have helped to pass moratoriums on fracking, have helped to pass bans on fracking in cities across the country.
New York did.
I know it was so. Yeah. When I got that news, I just was such a happy day.
Right.
And that didn't just happen. You know, it wasn't just that, you know, elected officials in New York saw the light. They were in a way forced to make that decision because the state mobilized across the state from the cities up throughout the northern parts of the state, mobilized chefs and eaters and farmers and mobilized, organized.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the story of New York State is a story of what a win looks like when you really bring people together, who don't always sit around a table together, but who have a shared goal. And that is really, I know New York State has inspired states across the country. So, mm-hmm. So that's an example I would give. I mean, one of the groups that I'm really involved in is a group called Rainforest Action Network. And I'm involved with RAN, as we call ourselves, because I also think it's a great organization like Food and Water Watch that gives people across the country a way to kind of patch in and connect in to campaigns that help them go beyond their fork. I mean, part of the challenge of going beyond your fork is that you can't do it alone, but that's also part of the power of it. So one of the campaigns that RAN has been really a leader in, has been exposing the connection between palm oil production in Indonesia and Malaysia and climate change. Palm oil has become one of the most widely traded vegetable oils in the world. It's used in a lot of processed foods in the United States. It's in everything from cookies and crackers to peanut butter. So when you get that peanut butter that's already creamy, you don't have to stir. You can thank palm oil for that. The problem with palm oil is that it's being grown on these massive plantations that are being sited on former peatland and former rainforest. In other words, lands that were incredibly carbon rich. And climate scientists talk about this kind of palm oil production that's happening, and the destruction of this land is kind of almost like releasing carbon bombs into the atmosphere. It's a major, major source of carbon dioxide emissions, of man-made carbon dioxide emissions. And so RAND has been working on a campaign to pressure companies, especially companies that brands that you and I know, like General Mills and Pepsi, to pressure those companies, to put pressure on their palm oil suppliers to commit to not sourcing palm oil from places that are such a danger to the climate. And so, you know, again, I, as an activist, I'm not going to have that opportunity to sit down at the table with Cargill and say, this is what I want. I want a climate-stable future for my kids. But I can, you know, connect up with a group like Rainforest Action Network and kind of give a little bit of my wind behind their sails to really help them run a campaign that does mean that we have RAND representatives sitting down at the table with some of the biggest food companies in the world and helping them and pushing them to draft real binding policies around limiting where and how they're sourcing their palm oil. So those are just two examples, like Food and Water Watch and RAND, that I would call out as ways that we can we can get involved. And then here in my new town of Berkeley, California, I was involved with the community effort to pass a soda tax, and that was a great example of community coming together up against major opposition by a big, well-funded industry. But that was a great example. I think a lot of people here felt incredible, that it was incredibly energizing to get involved with that fight to pass and to win a soda tax here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there's a lot of good work going on, and, you know, as we talked about at the beginning, if we can really help encourage people and motivate them to get involved, not only will they be helping the planet, but they'll be enriching their own lives, because they will then become part of a community that is doing good work, make new friends, and it's good all the way around. So can't believe we're out of time. I have so many other things I wanted to talk to you about, but we'll have to wait for another time, because an hour goes fast.
It does. And this is such a pleasure. And one thing I just want to say is I feel like I feel like as we think about these questions about what we eat, I think one of the other questions we should be asking is, what is the media we consume, not just the food we consume? So shows like yours are really a critical part of that.
Yes, I agree. So everyone who's been listening, thank you so much. Have a great rest of the day. I hope to see you at the Long Island Food Conference and in Albany on Tuesday. Have a great rest of the week. Bye for now.
This is